Good evening, everyone, and thank you to Professor Galligan for the very kind invitation, and to his colleagues Fiona and Judy for helping with the arrangements. It's been extremely helpful, and it's an honour to be here. So I'm going to talk about the referendum process tonight, and by way of scene setting, I'm managing two laptops tonight, so for someone who's not very technical, this is quite a challenge. But on the 23rd of June, the British people will vote on this proposition: should the United Kingdom remain a member of the European Union or leave the European Union? And this will be only the third United Kingdom-wide referendum, but it is part of a growing trend. Two referendums were held in 2011, one UK referendum on the AV voting system, and one in Wales on further devolution, while, of course, in 2014, we had the Scottish independence referendum. The EU referendum is clearly of huge significance. The UK has been part of an integrating Europe for 40 years, and our departure will have profound implications. The United Kingdom's own constitutional future is also at stake, not least because the Scottish government is threatening another independence referendum in the event of an exit vote, or at least in the event of a Article 50 process following an exit vote. And in political terms, the referendum could affect the future of the government, the Prime Minister, and potentially even the Conservative Party. Now, while the focus of the referendum will obviously be upon important substantive issues, economics, migration, security, etc., which determine whether the United Kingdom is better off inside or outside the European Union, as well as the possible political fallout that I've mentioned, what we should not underestimate, I think, is the importance of process. What is often overlooked is that the credibility of the outcome on 23rd June, whatever that might be, will depend greatly upon the legitimacy of the referendum as an event. And indeed, when we look at the current debate, given the heat which that is now generating and the concomitant prospect of an ill-tempered and potentially bitter referendum campaign, it is of the highest importance for the future of the country afterwards that the process of the referendum itself be fair and be seen to be so by both sides. In other words, that the result is agreed to, even if it is not agreed with, by losers as well as winners. So that's why I want to consider this broader question this evening: can referendums in general be democratic, before turning to the specific prospects for the 23rd of June? For some people, this might seem like a strange question. For them, it's almost an intuitive assumption that referendums represent an ideal model of democracy. The voters are called upon to speak as one unified people, deciding on an issue directly, without the mediation of politicians. What could be more democratic than that? When we think of democracy as rule by the people, organised on the basis of individual equivalence, the referendum seems to fit the bill very well. It gives a directly determining voice to the demos in a way that captures neatly the people's popular sovereignty and the political equality of all citizens. And that's one of the reasons why Vernon Bogdanor, one defender of the referendum, once stated, "Arguments against the referendum are also arguments against democracy." I should say that wasn't necessarily Professor Bogdanor's view. He was expressing a precis of that particular argument, that in the referendum, government by the people is essentially being fulfilled. And certainly the mood of the day seems to be one that leans towards direct democracy. And I'm going to quickly run through a couple of slides just to illustrate this very briefly. Over the past few decades, we've seen a proliferation of the referendum across the globe. And in this first table, I offer a breakdown of how referendum use has grown in four main areas of constitutional practice. First, in the founding of new states, the referendum was widely used in the early 90s during the breakup of the USSR and Yugoslavia. And it's now become something of a default mechanism for the emergence of new states: Eritrea, East Timor, Montenegro, South Sudan, and so on. Kosovo is a possible exception, but even here, there were unofficial referendums. And Scotland and Quebec are examples of near misses, we could say. Secondly, referendums which were once very rarely used in the creation or amending of constitutions. Again, that has become something of a fad, and no sign of it becoming a passing fad. And again, we can trace the roots of that to Eastern Europe, following the collapse of the Eastern Bloc. But more recently, we're seeing it in post-conflict situations or transitional situations. And again, a few examples there. And a subset of that, we could call the third group a subset of that, we see referendums proliferate in respect of sub-state autonomy. UK and Spain are simply two examples. And the last one is interesting, I think, for the purpose of this lecture. We've seen a major proliferation of referendum use in the accession to and transfer of sovereign powers from European states to the European Union. And to take an example, of the first 15 countries to join the European communities, only Ireland and Denmark held referendums to ratify the decision. But of the 10 accession countries in 2004, only Cyprus did not. And we see this trend continuing in 2012 with Croatia and this new instance of a referendum on exit from the European Union, this unprecedented referendum which we will be having in the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom is not unaffected by this trend of proliferation. And within a 40-year period, I think the UK is a good example of how the referendum has gone from a highly exotic constitutional option to one that is increasingly normalised within constitutional practice. So again, the first referendums were Northern Ireland in 1973, and then going down to the United Kingdom referendum on Europe in 1975, third from bottom. This was unusual. Then we had a couple of referendums in 1979 on Scottish and Welsh devolution. But it's only really since the 1990s that we see this real proliferation, largely in the sub-state context, but now with two recent national UK referendums. So much so that the House of Lords Constitution Committee held an inquiry into referendums in 2010 and went so far as to argue that there was a case for a statute to set out what major changes should require a referendum. In other words, that Parliament should consider regulating what issues should be governed by referendums. This has not been taken forward, but it does alert us to the direction of travel towards direct democracy in the UK. So I started with that initial prima facie assumption that the referendum is on its face a democratic device. It represents the people speaking directly. But can it just be accepted that this proliferation of the referendum is a democratic good? In fact, the traditional reaction to referendum democracy among many constitutionalists and political historians is one of hostility. The mobilisation of direct popular rule is seen not as a virtue but as a problem, since it unleashes dangers which constitutions are specifically designed to prevent. For many liberals, the key point of constitutionalism is to restrain the will of the majority. And this traces back to the French Revolution, obviously, and the apocalyptic vision that has overshadowed democratic thinking, envisaging what can happen when unrestrained popular democracy prevails, characterized by mob rule, hot-headed judgments, and the tyranny of the majority. The referendum has been swept up in that image, and not entirely unfairly, since the plebiscite was one of the devices used by post-revolutionary France as it expanded its empire. But in this tradition, more generally in terms of theory, government for the people, not by the people, is the point of modern democracy, leading to the principle of representation, the removal of decision-making from ordinary citizens and placing it with those better suited to the task. So these themes emerge in democratic thinking. And what they've led to, I think, are three main criticisms that are levelled at the referendum, mainly but not exclusively from the liberal tradition. First is what I call the elite control syndrome. Referendums lend themselves, by definition, to elite control and manipulation. So a recurrent complaint in the literature is that referendums promise popular power including control by the people over elites, but are themselves so open to manipulation as to belie that promise. In other words, even if popular influence on constitutional processes is a Republican good, referendums do not deliver on that promise. And behind this objection lies the presupposition that an executive has the opportunity to shape the referendum process in order to achieve its objectives. And among the tools that are frequently cited to be at the disposal of elites are the initial decision to stage the referendum in the first place, the power unilaterally to frame the question, the capacity to determine the process rules by which the referendum will be conducted, rules which can then be shaped to play to the government's strengths, and, for example, and most importantly, manipulation of funding and spending regulations. So according to this critique, the government is virtually assured a successful outcome. As Arend Lippert, the Dutch-American political scientist, famously put it, most referendums are both controlled and pro-hegemonic. The second objection is the inbuilt tendency of the referendum to aggregate preformed opinions and not to foster deliberation, the deliberation deficit, as I call it. This objection is largely based upon some of the assumptions grounded in the first objection, and it is the idea essentially that public reasoning is absent from the referendum processes. We've seen the turn again over the past 40 years in political theory towards deliberative democracy. People trace it back to different sources, but if we take John Rawls as an early pioneer here, his concept of public reason will be familiar to most people here. And the argument is that this is simply absent in referendums. Representative government is a far better model of decision making because it's designed in a way that causes elected politicians to cooperate and in so doing to offer reasons for their views and decisions. By contrast, informed reflection upon and discussion of the issues at stake are not required in a referendum. You don't have to discuss things, you can just go and make your decision. And so they are therefore absent. Now, what we find undergirding this objection are a number of other assumptions, themselves often founded, I think, upon stereotypes, that referendums tend to be held quickly in response to a spontaneous political calculation made by the government, that voters are presented with an issue which they have not had time to learn about or debate, that voter confusion can be exacerbated by a deliberately obscure question, which in many cases pushes respondents towards a particular outcome, and that citizens with busy lives lack the time and incentive to engage with the issue and even the ability to understand it. And the result is that those who bother to vote do so in an uninformed way, largely following the cues set by the referendum's organisers. I'll mention very briefly the third objection. In many ways, this is a very, very substantial objection, but I'll explain why I'm not going to spend much time on it. But this is the majoritarian danger that referendums consolidate and reify majoritarian decision-making, which goes against the kernel of modern liberal constitutionalism, which is protection of minority rights. And the argument is that representative democracy does not suffer from this and from these other two failings to the same extent. So we're left with something of a conundrum. On the one hand, we have this intuitive assumption that referendums must be democratic, but a counter-argument that they are, in fact, dangerous. And in the work I've done on this elsewhere, I've argued that the problems identified with referendum democracy, and certainly the first two criticisms, are mainly problems of practice, not principle. And I've argued that the recent turn towards deliberative democracy offers us tools with which to construct referendums which can overcome, to a significant extent, both the elite control and the deliberation deficit criticisms. In other words, with careful planning and regulation, it's possible to construct what we might call a deliberative referendum, effective in mobilising meaningful public engagement on the big issues of the day. And I would argue in this respect that the Scottish independence referendum was something of a success. So something else I'll refer to as I go through the lecture is the Scottish referendum as a benchmark. as I reflect upon the prospects of the EU referendum and the possibility that within the EU referendum, what is the possibility, what is the likelihood that the elite control syndrome and the deliberation deficit might be successfully overcome? I will focus on those two and not on the third criticism that I mentioned, the majoritarian danger, because the United Kingdom is not a divided society with readily identifiable minorities whose interests are clearly imperiled by an exercise in majoritarian decision making. There's a slight qualification to that that some people have been presenting that I'll return to. But essentially, I'll focus on the first two issues, elite control and deliberation deficit. So turning first to this elite control syndrome that I mentioned, which comes with assumptions about a number of steps in the referendum process. The first one is the initiation power. The idea is that elites control the decision to hold a referendum. Now, in a sense, any referendum absolutely is elite controlled, as is any electoral process, if what we mean is that it's organised by the established institutions of the state. But the central issue really is how this power is allocated among institutions and whether checks and balances are in place. And the feature that tends to set alarm bells ringing is when the organisation power in a referendum rests exclusively in the hands of the executive, without a meaningful role for the legislature or for any level of independent oversight. Now, the first issue is the decision to set the referendum itself, and some countries have a constitutional provision whereby referendums have to be held for constitutional amendments. Ireland and Australia are two examples of this. So that takes elite control away to some extent. By contrast, the United Kingdom leaves the initiation of referendums to the discretion of central government, as we've seen in the referendums in 1975, 1979, the AV referendum in 2011, and the current referendum. And this has led to referendums being used for party political purposes. So in the early 70s, the Labour Party feared that a damaging split could emerge over membership of the European Communities and decided that a referendum would help avoid this by allowing a free vote to MPs, including ministers. Does this sound familiar? It's precisely the scenario that we have with the Conservative Party today, I would argue. The AV referendum in 2011 was also a party political, had a party political imperative. It wasn't so much a holding together referendum as a coming together referendum, bringing together the two parties in the coalition government. The referendum on AV was part of the deal to forge the coalition government. And as I say, in a similar way, the Brexit referendum can be seen as a political device, in this case to confront the UKIP threat and also to shore up a potential split in the Conservative Party. So this is really a high point of elite control in the UK system. Government can decide what to hold a referendum on and can decide this for political rather than principled reasons. The initiation of the Scottish referendum in 2014 was also held at the discretion of the Scottish government, stemming from the SNP's manifesto commitment. But one side effect of devolution was that the power actually to organise the referendum was shared between the UK and Scottish governments. So it was simply a bit of luck from the nature of devolution that power was dispersed between the two governments. And that led to the Edinburgh Agreement, which determined some of the process rules. There had to be a trade-off between the two governments in terms of when the referendum could be held, what the issue would be, and so on. So that's not something that happens at the UK level because it doesn't have to. So the overall point is that referendums in the UK are discretionary. And again, this calls to mind the House of Lords Constitution Committee recommendation of a statute. Interestingly, in that 2010 report, they cited membership of the European Union as one of the issues upon which referendums ought to be held. So were we to have had a statute on this, it's likely that the issue would have come to a referendum. It's not quite clear when it would have done so. It's also very difficult to remove this discretion. Referendums remain rare and generally I think it's difficult to see how you can constitutionally entrench a requirement, and that can lead to its own difficulties. One other area to look for is Parliament itself. Parliament to provide checks and balances on the principled use of referendums, rather than to look for a constitutional guarantee. What we don't have is a role for the courts, and that has emerged, for example, in Ireland, where the Irish court has intervened to require referendums in certain situations where the government preferred not to, ratification of European treaties being one example. So that's the elite control, that's the initiation power as one example of the elite control. It's looking quite elite in the UK system. The next issue is question setting. So even if the government controls initiation, that doesn't mean it can dominate the whole process. Question setting is often cited by those who see referendums as very manipulated as a major problem. Governments can simply set a leading question, or one that's torturous and difficult to understand, or one that combines different elements. So you have to vote for everything to get the one thing you like. The UK, I think, benefits here, as it does on a range of issues, from the statute in 2000, the political parties referendums, political parties elections referendums act. And this gives various roles to the Electoral Commission, including oversight of the question. So when the government proposes a referendum and it introduces a bill into Parliament with a question, that question has to go to the Electoral Commission. And the Electoral Commission publishes its views on the intelligibility of the question. Now, this is quite a soft power. It doesn't give the Electoral Commission the power to veto the question. It just has to publish its views on intelligibility. But what's quite interesting, two things are interesting. First of all, the Electoral Commission goes about its task of assessing intelligibility by asking people what they really understand. It sets up focus groups, it tests the question empirically, it assesses how people understand different words within the question, it takes the role very seriously. The second thing that's interesting is that that soft power has become quite a hard power in practice. So it proposed changes to the AV referendum and to the Scottish referendum question. I'll take the Scottish one as a first example. The Scottish government initially proposed, do you agree that Scotland should be an independent country, yes or no? And the Electoral Commission took the view, based on research, that this was not neutral, because it led people to say, yes, we agree. So they said, change the question to, should Scotland be an independent country? And the Scottish government, although not required by the Edinburgh Agreement, accepted this recommendation immediately. The political costs were too high for the Scottish government to not accept this question. And turning to Brexit, if we could call it that, we see again when the bill was introduced, the question was, should the United Kingdom remain a member of the European Union? So very similar to the Scottish question. And the Electoral Commission said that the question had concerns about the potential legitimacy of the referendum result. It's a quite hard-hitting critique from the Electoral Commission. It said it encouraged voters to consider one response more favourably. People were being invited to say the UK should remain. It recommended instead the question which we now have, should the United Kingdom remain a member? So you have to say remain a member or leave the European Union. And I think what's interesting about that is that within half an hour of the Electoral Commission issuing its view, a Downing Street spokesman confirmed that the government would table an amendment to the question in line with the Commission's proposals. So this is an example of how the Electoral Commission dilutes elite control in the UK system over the referendum question, and I think quite significantly in terms of making questions more neutral. Now, I mentioned that the dispersal of elite control relies upon Parliament in our system to check the executive. And the experience here has generally not been positive. All of those referendums that were held for party political purposes were accepted by parliamentarians. But we have seen one example in the design of the EU referendum process, which is actually an example of Parliament behaving robustly, and this is the Purdah debate. Purdah is the period that occurs 28 days before a referendum. And in that period, Section 125 of PIPERA restricts the publication of promotional material by central and local government. So there was controversy over a government attempt to exclude the operation of Section 125 so that it would apply only to publications directly relevant to the referendum. So when the European Union referendum bill was published, the government actually tried to exclude itself from Purdah limitations. It would still be able to publish in areas that were not directly relevant to the referendum. Now, this caused a rebellion on the government benches with a sense that this was a very vague provision that could give the government very wide leeway and could, in fact, allow it to intervene and to publish material in favour of its preferred option during the Purdah period. And that there was a serious backbench rebellion on this. And this was seriously curtailed in Section 8 of the 2015 Act. This still left the minister with some power to limit Section 125 by regulation, but the minister could only do this having consulted the Electoral Commission. Such regulations would need the affirmative procedure in Parliament, and they would have to be done no less than 4 months before the referendum, a date which has now passed. So in effect, that killed off any attempts to interfere with Purdah. So again, I think this is an example of how a simple story of elite control needs to be scrutinised a bit more closely. Checks and balances can exist within the system, depending upon the political will of parliamentarians to try and create this deliberative framework and restrict the power of the government. It doesn't always happen, but the power is there. The second critique that I mentioned, that referendums cannot foster meaningful deliberation. Well, it's one thing to regulate the influence of government, but what about this idea that citizens simply cannot be mobilised in a mature and informed way to really take ownership of a referendum? Well, again, something I've argued elsewhere is that just as legal regulation and process design can diminish elite control, so too can it help to foster the better deliberation of citizens. Another overall point which I want to throw out tonight is that when we do read the literature on referendums and the critical literature on referendums, what you find, I think, are some different standards. It's very common to judge referendums by different standards than elections. So if we conclude that citizens are not participating properly in parliamentary democracy, we look for solutions. We don't decide, well, it's not working very well, let's get rid of it. But it's quite interesting that when people look at referendum democracy and see, well, there's elite control here, quite often they say referendums should not be used. It's an ill-advised device. And I argue that that's maybe too quick, and therefore that the problems of referendums, if they can be avoided in practice, then we shouldn't dismiss them too quickly from the portmanteau of democratic decision making. So what kinds of things are we talking about here? Well, the first one is engagement. One argument within the deliberation deficit critique is simply that citizens don't engage. They turn up, if they bother to turn up, they turn up at the voting booth and they just vote according to their party queue, and that's that. So clearly voting patterns are significant to bearing this out. And in some referendums, certainly we see very poor turnout. The Wales referendum in 2011 on further devolution, only 35% voted. And in the AV referendum in the UK, 42%. So these are low turnouts. But it also seems that engagement can be improved by registration systems and public information. And certainly advising on the Scotland referendum bill, there were significant efforts to really register people to vote. That was an issue because younger voters were being given the vote. But there were very concerted efforts to put out public information about the referendum. The Scottish turnout of 84%, however, cannot be put down to that. It's really an issue about the salience of the matter that people were being asked to vote about. 84% turned out in the Scottish independence referendum. In Quebec, their sovereignty referendum in 1995, 94% turned out. So I think there's good reason to believe the European Union referendum will also have good turnout. But a wider question is not simply participation, it's deliberation, the quality of that participation. Does that really involve reflection and discussion of the issue by citizens? Does the referendum really offer a meaningful space for an exercise in collective public reason by citizens who understand an issue, engage with it, and take their own independent view on the matter? The level of debate in the Scottish referendum suggests that people really can engage with these issues, and a lot of the empirical work that's been done since, asking voters and campaigners how they felt the referendum went in deliberative terms, has produced quite a lot of feedback to the effect that people did really engage, sought out information, really discussed things on social media, and so on. And certainly living through that, that was certainly a sense I got, that people were debating these issues all the time. I had one incident in dropping the kids off at primary school where I heard two 10-year-olds having a conversation, and one said, "There's no way David Cameron will agree to a currency union." And the reply was, "Of course he will, because he'll have to agree to it." So even 10-year-olds were getting involved in the debate. So the lesson, I think, is simply that the importance of the issue provokes citizen participation. And that's maybe an argument not against referendums, but against their overuse, that referendums can be a useful device if they're preserved for issues of really high salience to citizens. And it's a prediction, but it would seem to me that the EU referendum over the next few months will garner a similar level of interest. Another question, though, is not simply getting citizens to take an interest, but who participates? A referendum might be deliberative, but is it democratic? And there's a number of issues there about who really gets involved. But one interior question is the franchise. And this is interesting in that the European Union Act follows the UK parliamentary election franchise, and it includes Irish and Commonwealth citizens satisfying residence requirements, but it does not include EU citizens resident in the United Kingdom, apart from EU citizens who are either Irish or Commonwealth citizens, such as Maltese or Cypriots. And in second reading debate, the Foreign Secretary, Philip Hammond, said it would be a travesty to seek to include EU nationals whose interests might be very different from those of the British people. Now, this is a contrast to the Scottish referendum where EU citizens could vote. This is a big question. You know, does the fact that this issue, the issue at stake is membership of the European Union, does that, as Philip Hammond say, make it outrageous that EU citizens in Britain shouldn't have the right to vote? Or does it make it outrageous that they shouldn't, precisely for that reason? So, you know, this is really a question for people's personal views. But I think it is interesting that people say, well, it might be deliberative, but it wasn't democratic. I wasn't included. I've lived here for many years, and I'm a EU citizen, and I wasn't able to vote here. How can you call that democratic? This became a big issue in other referendum processes in the Baltic states after the collapse of communism, where there were so many ethnic Russians in Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia, and then the issue was, should they be able to vote, should they not? We also saw it in the Balkans, recently the Montenegro referendum in 2006. Montenegro is such a small country. The issue is, what about Montenegrins, people born in Montenegro who now lived in Serbia, and so on, should they be allowed to vote? So this can be a very fraught issue in many systems. It's unlikely to be a hugely fraught issue here, but it is interesting. Other issues, the Scottish referendum, the franchise was extended to 16 and 17-year-olds. That's not happening in this referendum. People have different views about that. One of the arguments in Scotland was this would increase deliberation, it would increase the number of people involved, and so on. More minor issue in terms of numbers is prisoner voting. We've got this whole debate in the UK about prisoner voting. There's a generally accepted view. I wrote an opinion for the Scottish Parliament before the Scottish referendum arguing that the Article 3, Protocol 1 would not apply to referendums, since it only applies to elections for the choice of the legislature. And on that basis, it was lawful to exclude prisoners from the referendum. That was upheld by the Supreme Court. Prisoner voting has not raised its head in this referendum. So that's the question of the if you like, who can vote. There's also this question about the United Kingdom. Now, I mentioned I wasn't going to talk about the majoritarian problem, but one issue that has arisen is this idea of the UK as a multinational state. Because while the EU debate's going on, at the same time we're having the Scotland Bill debate and the Wales draft bill, and there is this bigger question now about, is Britain moving in a more federal direction, as it seems to be? And that's led to the Scottish Government to say that it would be improper for the United Kingdom to vote to leave the European Union unless there's a majority to do so in the four parts of the United Kingdom. So obviously that's had no political traction at UK level, but it has come with a bit of a threat from the Scottish Government that they would want to revisit the independence issue were this to happen. It's quite interesting that this might be another objection to referendums, that they are not sufficiently sophisticated to deal with federal societies. I'm not saying the United Kingdom is federal. But when we look at constitutional amendment in federal societies, you need a supermajority of provinces in Canada or states in America to effect constitutional change. With a referendum, the referendum is blind to those kind of territorial differences. One option that I've mentioned in writing on this is whether you can actually have a referendum even in a divided society, and one option would be a consociational referendum, whereby you would need a majority among different ethnic groups. So the disaster of the referendum in Bosnia in 1992 could arguably have been avoided on that basis. In effect, the Northern Ireland referendum of 1998 was sort of consociational, since it was people implicitly were taking exit polls to make sure that a majority on both sides voted for the Belfast Agreement. So I'm certainly not arguing for a consociational referendum for the EU, but just to explore this idea that is one of the problems with referendums, that they're too crude to deal with territorial pluralism. Another issue is timing. In creating a deliberative environment, timing is often identified as important, that a referendum happens too quick, people can't really think about it, they have to vote immediately. You can look at the EU referendum in different ways. Some people have said, oh, it's been rushed, the referendum is taking place in June, we thought it was going to be next year. I saw an unkind letter in the Telegraph last week that said the referendum is maybe happening in June, so there's still a European Union to leave. The others say, look, June's 4 months away. There's plenty of time here to deliberate. And that's, I mean, certainly that seems intuitively right in terms of the amount of time that campaigns can get organised and so on. Another complaint is that it's too close to local government and devolution elections. But again, it's 7 weeks after these in early May. The Electoral Commission has not yet commented. On the 20th of February, it said that it will offer its views regarding the date and the package of regulations about the referendum, but it hasn't done so yet. But a broader point about the timing issue is, again, in the United Kingdom, this is very much at the discretion of the government. The bill, the Act, the 2015 Act, was very open-ended. It allowed for a referendum before the end of 2017. And that was similar to the discretion available to the Scottish Government in 2014. They could set it at any time up to the end of 2014, which allowed them to manage exactly when it would be most propitious for a yes vote, to have it just after the Commonwealth Games and so on. So there is an issue there. One thing about the British experience is that when a date is set, it's stuck to. What we saw in Quebec in 1995 was, when the Nationalists thought they were going to lose, they moved the date from spring to October. Mercifully, that's not something that has occurred in the UK, but it's not inconceivable that it could. Certainly in legal terms, it's not inconceivable that it could. The regulations would permit that under the statute. So the situation is not entirely satisfactory. And especially when we consider that we have fixed term parliaments now, and one of the reasons for that was to reduce the discretionary power of the government to call elections when it suited the government, it seems that this ability to manipulate the dates of referendums begins to look more anomalous in that context. Now, I mentioned how regulation can moderate the question-setting process, but there's another matter relating to this, which is the substance of the issue at stake. In other words, I think we need to distinguish issue framing from question-setting. So a question might be short and clear and neutral, but does it present an issue that people can really understand, an issue suitable for citizens to determine, and an issue that people actually want to vote on? One of the issues to come out of the Scottish referendum was that the people were not offered the most popular option, further devolution. So when the polls were taken before, do you want the status quo or independence? The plurality of opinion was more powers. That wasn't on the ballot. Part of the Edinburgh Agreement was specifically to exclude that from the ballot. In the end, the No campaign did campaign with that on the ballot, following the vow. So if you wanted to vote for the status quo in the Scottish referendum, you couldn't. The two options you were faced with was independence or some open-ended commitment to more powers, which you didn't know about. And that led to the very undeliberative Scotland Bill. So ironically, what I'm arguing was a very deliberative referendum led to a very undeliberative constitutional outcome. Similar issues arise in relation to the EU referendum. It seems that, well, it's not doesn't seem, that it's clear from the polls that a plurality of opinion across the UK wants to stay in the EU, but would like to stay in a UK, in an EU that is restructured altogether, or at least involves repatriation of significant powers to the UK, where that possible. Now, where this referendum differs from the Scottish process is that that is not in the gift of the UK government to give. The UK government simply can't offer a referendum on that preferred option because it's not in its power to do so. Many people might not like the two options on offer, but it's the only game in town. So this leads to another argument that the referendum is a crude device, and that unless an issue lends itself obviously to an either-or scenario, it can produce perverse incentives. Many people may vote to leave the EU because they don't know what else can be achieved. And of course, there's been some ridicule of the suggestion by Boris Johnson and others that a no vote will really show, force the EU to show its real hand, and that that will lead to a new agreement and a second referendum. And some people laugh at this. But this has been presented by what we might call the soft exiters, people who are not opposed to EU membership but don't like the deal on offer. And their concern is we're being forced to choose between two things, neither of which we want. And this, and my question is, can you really have proper deliberation when the voters who really engage find that they're just frustrated because we want to deliberate, but we're not been able to deliberate about the thing we want to talk about? So it's just, I think it's irresoluble. A couple of things I'll mention very briefly is that there are other ways to do the issue framing rather than the question setting. British Columbia in 2003-2004 handed an issue of electoral reform over to the citizens. It set up a citizens' assembly. People picked at random from the voters' register, two people from each constituency, put in a room for a year, not every day. They met at weekends. It's a very Canadian kind of thing to do. They met at weekends, high-spirited citizens, and they came up not only with the issue, with the topic of electoral reform, what model would be put to the voters. They even framed the question. Now, this is the high end of citizen engagement. Citizens set the issue. Now, you could say this is unrealistic. The parties didn't like the option that was put up, and it didn't extend to the macro level. So you had great deliberation in this room. When it went out to the citizens, they were like, we're not voting on this. We don't want this system. So it didn't extend deliberation from the micro level to the macro. So anyway, there was all kind of problems with that. The Australian did it in a more sensible way of bringing some politicians together with more civil society people. So just to mention that there are other ways to introduce deliberation at the issue framing stage before you even get to question setting. Doesn't always work. The Australian one didn't really work all that well either, but there we are. Now, the final thing I want to mention is one of the main criticisms of referendums is that they can be the subject of widely distorted expenditure, with voters subjected to very disproportionate advertising. And of course, this is the big criticism about referendums in America, where restrictions on campaign funding run up against the First Amendment interpretation that makes it almost impossible. I mean, I'm not an expert on First Amendment interpretation, but people will no doubt correct me if I'm wrong on that. But there was a significant case a few years ago that led to that conclusion. So this leads to an issue, and one argument is you can't have a deliberative referendum unless you have a level playing field. If people are spending too much, that's going to distort things. Also, if campaign donations are open-ended, then you get the distortions of vested interests. Big business and other pressures can simply pump money into the referendum. The UK, I think, regulates this pretty well. You'll get some people who argue not, but I think it does. The PIPERA regime sets a campaign period within which strict spending rules apply. Prior to this, groups are invited to put themselves forward as designated organisations, one for each proposition. And they can be given grants, public money up to £600,000. They're also given a free mail shot to each household and referendum campaign broadcasts. So the state guarantees a minimal level of support for designated organisations. The referendum period is typically 10 to 16 weeks. Ministers have discretion here. They even have discretion here under the EU Referendum Act. But the Electoral Commission pushes this, and the Electoral Commission is increasingly saying, push the campaign period wider to 16 weeks so that when the organisations designate themselves, the spending rules kick in. And the Scottish Government accepted that, and that's how the Scottish independence referendum ran. As soon as there was Better Together and Yes Scotland, they immediately were under the rules. Four categories of spending. So the designated organisations can spend 7 million. The third group, permitted participants, and those who can spend less than 10,000. So that's not typically a significant group. The big question, the EU referendum, is the second group, and I'll come back to that in a moment. One criticism, before I get to that point, is my final substantive point, is that one criticism of PIPERA is that people could get together and act in concert. So you could get lots of little companies who would call themselves a permitted participant, intended to spend about £10,000 or more than £10,000. And they would basically be linking together, acting in concert, and could therefore really raise lots and lots of money. The 2015 Act has operated based on the Scottish legislation to try and deal with that, so that groups who look as though they're acting in concert will be seen by the Electoral Commission in that way. I think that could be very significant in this referendum. So the final substantive point really is the party issue. Now, the way what political parties can spend and goes on how you performed at the last election. So based on that, the Conservative Party, you'll see basically Labour, Lib Dems, SNP and Greens can spend about together about 6 million more than UKIP. The Conservative Party have declared themselves neutral in the campaign. So they are not going to throw their 7 million into the Remain campaign. If they did, you would see how potentially distorted this could become. You would have the parties, the Remain parties, or the Remainians, as Liam Fox called them this week, massively outspending those for exit. Now, people have different views on this. People say, well, that simply reflects the will of the parties. In democracy, why shouldn't they? You know, they shouldn't have their hands tied and not be allowed to express a view. Others say this doesn't lead to a level playing field. I just throw that out there. And reporting, another issue is reporting. Under the PIPERA, reporting all came after the referendum. In the Scottish referendum, we got interim reporting, and that's in the 2015 Act. And that means the Electoral Commission can keep an eye on spending as it goes along, so that some organisation doesn't just think, well, we might get fined after the referendum, but if it's worth getting us out of Europe or keeping us in Europe, just break all the rules. And that's not going to happen. Spending by foreign sources is really regulated. Permitted participants must refuse donations above £500 from non-UK donors. And David Lidington, the Minister for Europe, said that basically means that the European Commission and foreign governments can't be permissible donors. The European Union has a track record in referendums of interfering like crazy. The European Commission helped fund the pro-Euro campaign in the 2000 Danish referendum. During the 1990 Irish referendum on the Amsterdam Treaty, it issued a document, the Citizen's Guide to the Amsterdam Treaty, which was seen widely as a propaganda exercise. It spent heavily in the Lisbon Treaty and the EU referendum in Ireland and so on and so on. And there was a lot of foreign involvement in the French referendum on the draft constitutional treaty. So although it's unlawful for permitted participants to take money from the EU and so on, I don't know if the legislation would be robust enough to resist very strong pressure from the EU to really intervene. What might stop it would be the risk of counterproductivity. It may well be that the Remain side would say to the European Union, the last thing we need, which was largely the better together approach in the Scottish referendum, the last thing we need is you showing that you're this hegemon, we need to leave. So just to conclude, information to citizens, this is a tricky one. There is provision in PIPERA, because another thing about deliberation is citizens need time and space to debate issues and information. The Electoral Commission issues leaflets. They tend to be very vague. The Electoral Commission will not commit itself to defining the two propositions. What they tend to do is give space to the two sides to say what their views are, and they will not really get involved in doing this. There are a couple of provisions in the Act, Section 6 and Section 7, that require the UK government, this is unprecedented, to issue to publish the deal. So the UK had to publish the deal that it reached with the EU. And secondly, to publish more information about rights and obligations that arise under the European law, under European Union law, as a result of UK membership, and examples of countries that do not have membership but have other arrangements within the European Union. So there's an obligation under Section 7 of the UK to explain both sides. Now, I don't know how that's going to work and whether the Electoral Commission will overview it. So a couple of words in conclusion. Referendums have a bad name in political theory, but I hope what I've shown here and in wider work is that two of the main criticisms, elite control and deliberation deficit, can in part at least be overcome by regulation. The UK experience is a bit of a mixed bag, but there are indications through PIPERA, the Electoral Commission, and Parliament's approach to PIRDA that the opportunity of government simply to manipulate referendums is more limited than people might think. Deliberation is more difficult to guarantee, as it is in elections. The Scottish referendum suggests that citizens, if they think something is important, they will seek out information and they will deliberate. And here spending regulations are crucial. And in the Scottish referendum, the spending regulations worked really, really well. There were no complaints by either side about abuse by the other. But a final point I think that I'd finish on is certainly this idea that referendums can be judged by different standards from ordinary elections, and there's no principled reason for this. In the end, the people are being given the power over this issue, and it's a responsibility upon everyone, not least academics with expert knowledge of the issues, also to play our part in helping to facilitate a deliberative referendum. The stakes in June are very high, as they were in Scotland in 2014, not just on the substantive issue. So regardless of one's views on the outcome, the one thing no one wants is a divided country, with one side feeling that it was robbed. So I think we therefore all have a duty to do what we can to help produce a process which citizens, even if they don't like the result, will respect as the outcome of a fair and democratic national conversation. Thank you.